Get ready, people.
People, get ready. The train a coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board.
That's right. Grab your carry-on bags. This train is bound for November. Ready or not, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 4th. A huge crowd of 30,000 Obama supporters were ready last night in St. Paul. Obama says he's ready for November. John McCain says he's ready for Obama. And Hillary Clinton says she's not ready to concede. Also, it's summer blockbuster movie time. Nigerian films are taking off. And a look back at Tiananmen Square in a year when China is determined to look forward. That and all the news. After a grueling primary season, Barack Obama says the Democratic presidential nomination is all his.
Because of you, tonight I can stand here and say that I will be the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States of America.
Obama praised Hillary Clinton for making him a better candidate. Clinton won the South Dakota primary and then addressed her supporters last night in New York. She congratulated Obama but did not concede defeat. The two candidates spoke around midnight, and Obama spokesman says his boss is offering to meet with her when she finds it convenient, but there are no firm plans yet. A statement from the DNC chairman, Howard Dean, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urges remaining uncommitted superdelegates to make their decisions known by Friday.
In a speech delivered just outside of New Orleans, John McCain welcomed his opponent with a reminder that he's been campaigning for president for years.
The American people didn't get to know me yesterday, as they're just getting to know Senator Obama.
McCain says his record of reform offers the kind of change the country needs, while Obama, he says, is just offering empty promises. After weeks of waiting, U.S. Navy ships waiting off the coast of Myanmar are leaving. The ships are loaded with relief aid for cyclone victims, but the government there refused permission for them to dock.
Israeli's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is meeting with President Bush in D.C. Expected agenda items include Israel's fears that Iran could obtain nuclear weapons and the Israeli government's attempts to negotiate peace with the Palestinians and Syria. What probably won't be discussed is how Olmert's new corruption scandal is threatening his office. A huge fire at a petroleum terminal in Kansas City, Kansas, is being blamed on lightning. The fire broke out as a line of thunderstorms moved through the area. The stormy weather caused at least three tornadoes in southern Indiana.
Could there be any good news on Wall Street? For a second straight day, the Dow tumbled more than 100 points to close at 12,402 yesterday. The S&P begins the day at 1,377. We got tons of responses from our takeaway question yesterday. What's your favorite cover song? The Impressions were covering Curtis Mayfield there with People Get Ready. Give us more cover songs, or try this. If The Campaign was a B-movie, a B-movie serial, what would you call it? Something like The Mod Squad Takes the White House, someone last hour, I think, said the Longest Yard.
The Longest Yard.
Yeah. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. What would you name the campaign?
Happy Birthday, John.
That's a really weird title.
No, but
that's
it's your birthday
strange,
today,
strange.
And I'm
true.
Wishing you
okay.
a good day.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This was the moment. This was the time when we came together to remake this great nation so that it may always reflect our very best selves and our highest ideals. Thank you, Minnesota. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
A goosebump moment, to be sure, but a moment that was a long time coming. And some could say that Barack Obama limped to the finish line, losing the South Dakota primary yesterday while winning the Montana primary. Nevertheless, well over enough delegates to clinch the nomination to make Barack Obama the first African-American candidate to lead a major party into a presidential campaign. So regardless of the details, history was made last night. But the question is, 30,000 people showed up in St. Paul, Minnesota. On the line is Rachel Stassenberger, who is a reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Aside from sort of putting a stick in the eye of the Republicans, because Minnesota is where they're going to be holding their convention in September, why was St. Paul and Minneapolis a good place to begin a November campaign speech last night? You were at the rally, Rachel. Why do you think Minnesota was a good place to begin?
Well, I think we're one of the battleground states. We're kind of a purplish-tinged blue here in Minnesota. And I think that that's part of the reason that St. Paul and Minnesota get some attention this time of year.
Purplish-tinged blue.
There you go.
That's this year's black.
Yes.
I guess. So what were the messages and the themes that you heard last night? And we have some tape from the Obama speech that I want to play, but why don't you begin?
Well, I think we heard, as we've been hearing throughout the campaign, the message of change. And Obama last night directed that more towards McCain than he has in the past. He certainly had his sights on the general election and is moving past the primary. I thought we heard a lot of words about unity, not only within the Democratic Party, but within the country totally.
All right, let's listen to Obama speaking in his own words last night.
At this moment, a moment that will define a generation, we cannot afford to keep doing what we've been doing. We owe our children a better future. We owe our country a better future. And for all those who dream of that future tonight, I say, let us begin the work together. Let us unite in common effort to chart a new course for America.
Now, Rachel, certainly Barack Obama, the movement, delivered the greatest amount of momentum to the Obama candidacy in the early going in the primary season. But I'm wondering, at this point, between now and November, is the movement Barack Obama going to have as much power as maybe some other kind of more pragmatic candidate? And what evidence did you see of either one last night?
Well, I think we saw last night the kind of intensity that has followed Obama's campaign for quite some time. One commentator last night described it as almost messianic. There were people who waited in line for 12 hours to get in.
12 hours?
12 hours. Some even started waiting the night before, and they were told to move along, and they came back at 6:15 in the morning. You saw a lot of young people, a lot of first-time voters, a lot of people who hadn't been involved in politics very much before.
You said that his message of hope has really gone over well in that state. Still true?
I think that is still true. I think we saw it last night. We saw it in the intensity. His speech, which was only about 27 minutes long, was interrupted 50 times by applause. So I think we saw it from that crowd. It's going to be interesting to see if some of the more establishment folks, some of the independents, where they end up, given that they have a choice between, looks like, Barack Obama and someone who's been known as a maverick in John McCain.
Hmm. Well, you know, speaking of John McCain, the Republicans, I suspect, will be hard-pressed to deliver the kind of enthusiasm that you saw last night around that arena. Do you think it will be a challenge for them?
I think it's a different kind of enthusiasm. I think we sort of saw the rock star politician last night, and I think when McCain comes to Minnesota, as he's expected to later this month for a fundraiser and probably again and again throughout the season, you'll see a lot more people who have more experience in politics. And in some ways, that experience may make a difference in the end.
All right. Themes and images of a campaign that is now just beginning, even though five months we've been doing this. Rachel Stassenberger.
It doesn't feel like it's just
beginning. Exactly. Rachel Stassenberger covering the Obama victory celebration last night in Minneapolis. She works for the St. Paul Pioneer Press.
It was a split decision last night. You had Hillary Clinton winning in South Dakota. But overall, Barack Obama claiming victory, claiming that he has enough delegates to take the Democratic presidential nomination. But she isn't conceding the race to Obama yet, though she has told New York colleagues that she's open to the possibility of running for vice president if that would help the party's ticket in November. Adam Nagorny is watching the developments for the New York Times. Good morning, Adam. Thanks for joining us. And how would you characterize Clinton last night?
It wasn't a concession speech. She wasn't quite defiant, but she wasn't exactly conciliatory. It was someplace between defiant and conciliatory is where I would put it.
And interestingly enough, let's take a quick listen to what she had to say to a very enthusiastic crowd.
Now, the question is, where do we go from here? And given how far we've come and where we need to go as a party, it's a question I don't take lightly. This has been a long campaign, and I will be making no decisions tonight.
Adam, that sounds a bit like the defiance that you were just talking about. But politically speaking, what options does she realistically have? Where does she go from here?
You know, I'm not sure she has many options at all. I mean, I think I never expected her to get out last night. Candidates normally give themselves a day or two, and I think you'll see the Democratic establishment, or whatever that is now, give her a day or two to make a decision. I think she'll probably sort of talk to people and sort of recover from what's been a very long, long period, and then, you know, now she's stepping aside. You know, the thing to watch is whether or not she's going to try to use whatever leverage she has to negotiate with Senator Obama, either in terms of getting a position on the ticket, but also, which might be a more pressing concern for her, is helping her retire her debt, which is pretty substantial at this point.
When you speak of leverage, specifically, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I'm actually not. She has some leverage to the extent that the sooner she gets out of the race in a peaceful way, the sooner Obama can begin to bring the party together and start focusing his attention on Senator McCain. I think that's about as far as her leverage goes. I mean,
But that's pretty significant, Adam. I mean, you know, it seems like you're already feeling the language twist a little bit. I mean, last night, by not conceding and by setting up this whole thing of, I want my 17 million people given visibility in this campaign as we go forward, it seems to me that is very close to an ultimatum about being on the ticket.
Right, but I'm not sure. Yes. But I'm not sure that's the best way to get yourself a position on the ticket. I mean, this is really going to be Senator Obama's first test here, because it's a really difficult position that Mrs. Clinton has, by design or not, put him in. I mean, generally, you don't want to be in a position where you look like you're muscling your way onto the ticket. And if that's the perception and the way you interpret it is a fair interpretation, I'm not sure Obama's going to respond to that.
And in addition, her call out to her supporters, let's listen to what she asked of them.
This has always been your campaign. So to the 18 million people who voted for me and to our many other supporters out there of all ages, I want to hear from you. I hope you'll go to my website at hillaryclinton.com and share your thoughts with me and help in any way that you can. And in the coming days, I'll be consulting with supporters and party leaders to determine how to move forward with the best interests of our party and our country guiding my way.
Now, Adam, she talked about wanting to unify the Democratic Party, but kind of rallying her troops and suggesting that she does have a lot of options at this point in time. Is that unifying?
Well, let's see what happens over the next couple of days. I think the reality is going to be you are going to see by Friday a whole series of big-name Democrats, A, get behind Senator Obama, and B, begin to move away from her if she doesn't get out of the race, or at least some way suspend her campaign, I suspect including many of her own superdelegates. So, again, I think we've got to give this a couple of days. That's why I said it's hard to characterize that speech. It's certainly not conciliatory. It's defiant at times, but if you listen to it, she keeps coming back to, I will do what it takes to unify our party, and she congratulated Senator Obama. But it was more defiant than conciliatory.
Last question. Do you think she will end up on the ticket as Barack Obama's VP nominee?
You're
going to
ask Adam Nagorny that?
What do you think the likelihood is of that?
I've learned long ago not to even try predictions. I think that there's a good argument for Senator Obama to do it in terms of, like, you know, dealing with supporters of Mrs. Clinton who feel angered by the way this process went. But there's also an argument for him to say, you know, the fact of the matter is my election shows the Democratic Party wants to move on beyond the era of the Clinton into the Bushes, and we're going to pick someone different. But the guy was saying before, he's got to figure out a way to finesse us because Mrs. Clinton...
Adam Nagorny from the New York Times. Thanks.
It's so unlike you.
No, I just wanted him to talk about the...
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about the campaign. We got a fantastic response at my take at thetakeaway.org. If you were going to name this campaign and give it the title of a B-serial movie, here's something from Douglas Anderson on our website. Baracula and the Bride of Clintonstein meet Senator McMummy. That's fantastic. Or another, the greatest show on earth, says Douglas Anderson. Not so much. If you want to learn, those are pretty good. Anyway, if you have a title for the campaign or anything else you want to respond to, 877-8-MY-TAKE is the place to go to join our conversation, and you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But of course, it is a historic day for Barack Obama, who won the Democratic nomination for president. But 19 years ago, there was another bit of history being made in Tiananmen Square in China. Weeks of a pro-democracy rally in Tiananmen Square that looked like a confrontation with the government and then looked like the possible herald for change and reform in China erupted amidst chants of long live democracy into violence. Nineteen years ago, the government opened fire on those demonstrators in what became known as the Tiananmen Square Massacre. It left a scar on the democracy movement in China. China is in a very different place this year, looking forward to the Olympics instead of backwards and dealing, of course, with the devastating impact of the earthquake. But 19 years ago, Kyle Gibson, a freelance journalist and filmmaker, was then working for ABC's Nightline. Kyle, you made it into Tiananmen Square as a reporter in a very unusual way. Can you describe how you witnessed the violence?
Well, I'd gone in earlier, John, to cover the uprising for Nightline, and we'd learned that anyone who had a hotel room near this square who was affiliated with a journalistic organization was being pulled away from rooms near this square. So another producer and I checked into the Beijing Hotel as man and wife on our honeymoon, and I told the desk clerk at the Beijing Hotel that all I wanted for my honeymoon was a view of Tiananmen Square, and this turned out to be about 5 days before the crackdown, so we were able to position our cameras from a 15th-floor suite that we called the honeymoon suite. The Beijing Hotel believed we were man and wife on our honeymoon and gave us this wonderful wraparound suite facing the square where we positioned the cameras. And then from there, I was able to run to this square the evening that we started to hear the low roar of a convoy approaching from the west. And then after that came 12 hours of violence.
And you've told me that you can still smell Tiananmen Square even today.
Yeah, it's strange. The images and the sounds will always be with me. It's never far away. I can't believe it's been 19 years. But there was a bitter smell in the air that night that I can't quite describe except to say that it was bitter. And it may have been gunpowder. It was also probably gasoline from the convoy. It was also the smell of the flames, these tanks that have been set on fire in the square. That smell stays with me, as does this odd... the sounds, the shouts, the wails, the approaching roar of the convoy, the gunfire that got louder and louder as the convoy approached from the west. Those images and the flames against the lampposts, which I was reminded of when I returned to Tiananmen last year.
Wow.
And Kyle, this has also been a historic year in terms of China hosting the Olympics soon and also the earthquake and the number of people who died. What parallels do you see from your experience in Tiananmen Square to the way that the government has been reacting to what's happening today?
I'm haunted by a couple of things. One is that, of course, they are trying to be much more open about this earthquake than other instances in the past, including Tiananmen. And I might add that I just want to pay tribute to Todd Carroll, who was the ABC bureau chief and a true expert on China, who 3 years after the massacre was still trying to cover Tiananmen and was beaten so badly he's never fully recovered. But now, as you saw with the earthquake, the leaders have opened up that area to the press and are trying very hard to show that they are paying attention to what has happened there. That said, as we've all seen, these protesters in the parents have been shut down.
Reporter Kyle Gibson, who at that time was working for ABC News Nightline. Today she's a freelance journalist and filmmaker living in Washington, describing the events that she witnessed 19 years ago in Tiananmen Square in Beijing.
We're just about 8 hours or so, give or take a little bit, since Barack Obama has called the Democratic nomination his, and Democratic leaders are urging their party's superdelegates to unite. A statement from DNC Chairman Howard Dean, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is urging remaining uncommitted superdelegates to make their decisions known by Friday. Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine, is with us today.
Hey,
and
Patrick.
What do you make of the speeches we heard last night, quickly?
Well, I was just so struck by Barack Obama because, remember, when he was 2 years old, there were many African Americans in parts of the South who couldn't vote. And to have him, you know, 45 years later, as the nominee for the Democratic Party is... I think we're like in a smug moment right now, a lot of us out there, especially journalists, but it's amazing.
It's amazing. It is a historic day, and we're going to get to more of it in a minute. But right now, we need some headlines, the latest headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Hello there. 27 minutes past the hour, Senator Barack Obama claims the Democratic nomination for president. Senator Clinton technically hasn't dropped out of the presidential race, but Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the national co-chair of the Clinton campaign, says she'd like to see Obama and Clinton on the same ticket. We'll have more from Congresswoman Schultz later this hour. Meanwhile, John McCain continues his run for presidency and is clearly focused on one word.
The direction of this country is going to change, right change and the wrong change, change dramatically.
Just a few of the changes that made it into John McCain's speech in New Orleans yesterday. McCain mentioned the word 30 times. Barack Obama talked about change 19 times in his Minnesota speech last night.
So he's kind of in a rut. On change. That's not change if you're in a rut.
It's like when you get a song stuck in your head, it goes over and over again.
People are going to say that I'm biased, I guess. I don't know. I thought that speech was dreadful last night, that McCain speech. So keep going, Femi. I'm going to get myself in trouble.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you doing the news, John.
Thank you.
May I continue?
Happy birthday from Femi.
Oh, my goodness. Someone's in a bad mood today. Go back to bed and get out the other side.
Yes,
okay?
All right, I will.
All right. Stand by, John. Okay.
Sorry.
I'll put you in the naughty corner. As we move on with our news, Zimbabwe's president is in Rome for an international conference on food and agriculture. President Mugabe says his country's food crisis is about the lack of foreign aid.
The United Kingdom has mobilized friends and allies in Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand to impose illegal economic sanctions against Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe's government has drawn harsh criticism from the United Nations after ordering 30 aid agencies to stop operations in Zimbabwe. And finally, NBA Detroit Pistons coach Flip Saunders is now out of a job. Days after bowing out of the NBA playoffs, Saunders is wrapping up his 3-year tenure. The whole team are on the trading block. The NBA finals start tomorrow night with the LA Lakers taking on the Boston Celtics.
Ouch, in Detroit.
Biston
poor Saunders. Saunders got his head handed
big
to him.
Game.
Yeah.
Big game tomorrow night. No question about it.
What do you think? Lakers or Celtics?
Lakers or Celtics?
Lakers.
Thanks, Femi.
It's Lakers.
Celtics?
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're talking about the campaign, and he didn't give us a B-movie title for the campaign, but Chris, via our website, said, when will Hillary Rodham Clinton and her supporters stop with the soap opera and start living in reality? I guess he wants her to get out of the race. I guess it won't be anytime soon. Patrick Henry Bass is with us, culture editor for Essence Magazine.
Senior.
Yeah, right.
Senior culture editor.
Senior culture editor. You know, one of the things that intrigues me, and I want to talk about the history of this campaign in a moment with somebody from the Quinnipiac Polling Institute, but it seems to me it's pretty interesting that a movement for change and someone different, which is how Barack Obama's campaign began, has merged with something deeper about racial justice in the United States. And they cross racial lines. What do you make of this kind of merger that's happened?
I'm glad you asked that question, because race has been the issue that everyone's sort of been avoiding throughout this entire process. And now it's sort of staring us right in the face. But I think if you look beneath that, just right under the surface, there's some optimism and hope that people aren't talking about that goes directly to what Barack Obama is saying about change and his life as a narrative. You know, this biracial kid, you know, with the father from Africa, you know, who has a Muslim name, who's a Christian, who went to Ivy League schools, who is as likable as Kennedy, is somehow, you know, he's been able to capture people across generations and from different racial backgrounds. And that's telling us that there are more possibilities to talk to each other across racial lines than we know.
It's even beyond that, though. It's almost as though Obama is saying, without someone who's African American in this picture of this narrative, it wouldn't be plausible. You couldn't do this with just a white person or a traditional sort of candidate. It has to embody kind of this polyglot quality of America.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, because I mean he wouldn't have any of the experience to talk about other than who he is,
right.
You know, and so in all those aspects of who he is informs who he is. So in that way he couldn't comment just as a white guy, or he couldn't comment as a white woman. He is Barack Obama.
Well, I guess the narrative of change now really does include a lot of people in this era, where perhaps maybe it didn't so much even a generation ago.
Oh, exactly. I mean,
it was just an anti-Washington message.
Barack Obama is the face of change, literally and figuratively. He is the face of change.
Well, how do you measure history in this campaign? You can certainly do it in sort of the terms that we've been talking about, but there are also some statistics that are pretty amazing in this campaign. Peter Brown joins us now. He's assistant director of the Quinnipiac Polling Institute. 5 months, 35 million votes, 56 contests, $500 million raised. Peter, if you were to point at the history-making data points in this campaign, where would you look?
Well, certainly the amount of money raised. I mean, the assumption has always been in American politics that Republicans can outrage Democrats. And this year, the Democrats just raised money like it was water. Also spent it like it was water. But they, between Senator Clinton and Senator Obama, they raised a humongous amount of money. And in fact, here's what's really interesting. Senator Obama needs to decide whether, in fact, he will take public money in the fall election, because he can raise so much privately that he would therefore not have to abide by federal spending limits. Whereas everyone has always assumed that the first person to break to not take the federal money because they could raise so much would be a Republican.
That's interesting, and we should point out that Barack Obama's contributors are small contributors.
Lots of small contributors. He also has lots of big contributors too, by the way.
Right. In terms of who showed up to the primaries, if you can compare it Republican versus Democrats, are there any interesting trends there, and is that relevant to November?
Well, there's certainly an interesting trend. Whether it's relevant to November is the $64,000 question. Clearly, Democrats showed up in humongous numbers this spring in the primary. Obviously, their primary race went much longer. It seems still to be going on, even though the primaries are over. The Republican race was wrapped up quite early. But even even early in the contest, when the Republican nomination was in doubt, in the same states, Democrats massively had the larger turnouts than the Republicans.
And there's actually a bunch of interesting facts about that Clinton beat Obama in states like California, New York, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, among others. But Obama received more votes in losing the Democratic primary in those states than McCain did in winning the Republican nominations there.
That's true, although you can say the same thing in 1972 about George McGovern, in that he massively out had a much larger turnout of people who voted for him in the primaries than voted in the Republican primaries for Richard Nixon. There is no historical correlation between having large primary turnouts in the spring and winning in November.
That's kind of scary for the Democrats, I would think.
Well, in fact, there's a professor at Manchester College in Indiana who had studied primaries from 1972 to 2004 and looked at which party had the larger turnout in a particular state presidential primary and then which party won that election in November. And there's no correlation. In other words, the party with the large turnout in the spring does not necessarily win in the fall. And in fact, in some cases, there's a negative correlation.
Do you think Barack Obama should be doing better at this point in the campaign versus John McCain than he's polling right now?
Well, I mean, I'm not... Let me answer it a different way, because most people would have thought that in a year in which the incumbent Republican president has the second lowest job approval rating in history, in which most Americans think we're in the middle of a recession, whether in fact we meet the technical definition of a recession, and in a year when there is a very unpopular war going on, all of which is tied to the Republican incumbent, political theory would tell you that the out party, that is the Democrats, should win easily. At this point, it's a very competitive race.
Wow. Peter Brown, assistant director of the Quinnipiac Polling Institute, with a lot of history there and a lot of cautionary information for both campaigns as we go forward. Thanks, Peter.
My pleasure. Bye.
Time for the latest headlines from Femi Okeh. Good morning.
Hi there, Dor. 21 minutes to the hour. Barack Obama claims the Democratic presidential nomination. John McCain tells Obama to bring it on. Hillary Clinton says she isn't pulling out of the race yet, and the Democratic Party tells superdelegates to get off the fence and make up their minds by Friday. General Motors' decision to stop production at four plants in Ohio, Wisconsin, Mexico, and Canada will affect 10,000 workers. Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle didn't try to conceal his worry.
My reaction was, I think, probably like everybody else's in the state, but maybe just because I know everybody here so well, it was just a kick in the gut.
GM is shifting its focus from trucks to smaller cars. The auto giant is considering selling the gas-guzzling Hummer brand. United Airlines will reportedly ground dozens of its least fuel-efficient jets to save money as fuel prices rise. There will reportedly be furloughs of union workers and a major reduction of routes. An announcement is expected later on today. And the Honda Civic has taken over as the nation's top-selling vehicle. Sales of the Civic increased by more than 33% last month, the latest evidence of a shifting trend away from the gas-guzzling pickups and SUVs.
And Hummers. Yeah, who would buy the Hummer company at this point? Patrick, what do you think?
Someone in Dubai.
Yes, and the answer is someone in Dubai. We do not have no more calls.
We don't know
who
it is.
We have a winner. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's June 4th, if you can believe that. And the summer movie season has gotten off to a booming start with big hits, the Indiana Jones movie and the Sex and the City movie, just to name two of them. But on the streets and in video stores, there are some new arrivals from the movie-making metropolis of
Nigeria.
You heard me, Nigeria, with films with titles like Mummy's Daughter Part 4, Beyonce, The President's Daughter, and End of Dreams. Nigeria, to a lesser extent, and Ghana are part of a booming nearly $300 million business that produces some 2,400 movies annually. And Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor with Essence, is with us. And what is a Nollywood movie?
A Nollywood movie is made for under $20,000 and often goes direct to DVD.
And?
Direct to DVD and VHS.
And it's essentially
made in Nigeria, in Ghana, in Burkina Faso. Small budgets. It borrows a little bit from Hollywood, a little bit from Bollywood.
And additionally, you have writers who write, produce, and often act in the movies.
Right, the actors iron their own clothes, you know, do their own makeup, their own hair. You know,
it's very low key. But there are they really are about morality tales.
Yeah, the morality tales, like, there are several categories of Nollywood films. The most popular in Nigerian Western African countries are tales that involve voodoo and religion and spirituality, but Christianity always wins over in the end.
Let's take a listen to one of the trailers.
Yes, and that was the limit.
You stay the hell away from my boyfriend, because if you don't...
You think it's all about money? It's all about money? Well, take it. Take it all. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want anything to do with it. Just leave me alone. Leave us alone.
That was from Beyonce, The President's Daughter, which is a Ghanaian film. And as you can hear, subtlety is not required in a Nollywood film. And that's what people like about it. They're over the top. They're melodramatic. They borrow a little bit from telenovelas, from American soap operas. Seldom quiet. And actually what's important in a Nollywood film is that the quality is kind of bad because it's sort of left of center. You know, and the films cost between $2 to $5. Or you can actually get, in some places, films $2, $4, $5.
And they're also in English, right?
Yeah.
And there are many languages in Ghana and also in Nigeria. So clearly they're trying to appeal to a larger audience. And the audiences are not just in West Africa or on the continent of Africa, for that matter.
They're in Canarsie. As a matter of fact, there's a guy who has a store. He has 4 video stores in Canarsie, and he has a television set outside his DVD shop, and he plays snippets of the films. And from what I understand, he's open almost 24 hours.
This is a trend that's really been bursting at the seams in recent months or years. How would you describe it?
I would say over the last year, it's definitely word of mouth. I heard about it from 2 coworkers. They were talking about Beyonce and Ciara. I thought that they were fighting it out for the cover of Essence magazine. But the characters in this Beyonce series, one is Beyonce, her rival is Ciara, 2 R&B singers. There are at least 2,000 films being made, Nollywood films being made. You consider that, and 200 films per month, between 90 to 200 films
so
per month.
So they're coming out.
You can buy them on the streets of Brooklyn.
Week.
Absolutely.
Patrick Henry.
Not just Brooklyn, Hartford, Connecticut as well.
Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine. Thank you.
Nollywood.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 4th, and the Democratic primary process, the last vote has been cast, and that was yesterday in Montana and South Dakota. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, have you been to bed yet?
For about 3 hours.
You are a Florida congresswoman, the national co-chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and you spent last night with the senator at her big rally here in New York after an historic five-month primary. Is the Clinton campaign over?
I think the Clinton campaign is going to go through some introspection. The Clinton campaign is not over at this point. Senator Clinton has not made any decisions, and there are a lot of conversations that need to be had before the primary process comes to a conclusion.
You were with the senator last night, and she spoke with Barack Obama. What did she say about the call?
I didn't hear about the call.
And what was her reaction to him declaring victory last night, as it appears that he may have the numbers to meet the delegate count?
She's really focused on pursuing the issues that are important for during the general election. And she wants to make sure that those issues are addressed, and that that we have an agenda in the Democratic Party that is going to be really addressed during the general election. That was really her focus. It was the focus of her speech last night, and over the next you know, days and period of time, she's going to talk to advisors, and she asked last night her supporters across the country to communicate with her through her website and let her know what they think.
You talked about this is John Hockenberry, Congresswoman. You talked about a period of introspection in the campaign, but I wonder if we're also talking about a period of negotiating behind the scenes. I mean, is the Clinton campaign prepared to negotiate with the Obama campaign about some sort of signal that might then trigger a concession move on the part of Senator Clinton?
At this point, after the end of the primary process, the campaign will, you know, sit down and evaluate, you know, the landscape now, and I know she's going to consult with advisors and supporters. And again, she's asked her supporters across the country to log
right.
on.
You said that, but what I'm asking is a little bit different. Are you negotiating with the Obama campaign on a quid pro quo issue?
And I'm going to answer the same way. At this point, the campaign is in a period of introspection, not negotiation.
So you're not looking for a signal from the Obama campaign to trigger concession.
No. What we're looking for is for her supporters across the country to communicate with her on what they think.
Well, what are they going to say? I mean, what kinds of things would they say? Like, Hillary,
well,
stay in.
One of her supporters. And, I mean, what I think should happen next is that some communication needs to occur between the Obama and Clinton campaigns, and they need to reach a conclusion that he and she should run as a ticket. I mean, I think the only way and the best way for us to ensure victory for the Democratic nominee in November is for them to combine their strengths in terms of experience, in terms of demographic support, and run as a team.
There are clearly strong feelings on both sides, by Barack's supporters and by Hillary's supporters. How do you think them joining together, that would be the best way to heal the wounds, perhaps, or some of the bitterness that we've seen?
I think that's the only way that we are going to make sure that we unify the party and make sure that all of the supporters of both campaigns are enthusiastically behind this ticket. I can tell you there are a lot of hurt feelings, and this is a campaign that has come down to virtually the last vote. Even yesterday's primaries, Montana and South Dakota were split by the two of them. So it's incredibly important that we unify, and the best way to do that is for them to run together.
So it sounds like you're saying that you're not necessarily going to concede until that ticket is offered.
No, don't put words in my mouth. What I'm saying is, in my opinion, I think that they should run together.
All right, and with the Hillary on the bottom of the ticket?
I think that they should run together at this point.
All right.
I think it's pretty clear what order that would occur in.
All right. Thank you very much. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the 20th Congressional District from Florida, is the co-chair of the National Clinton campaign. But it raises a very interesting and important point. Hillary Clinton won more than 17 million votes in the Democratic primary, and John Vivo and Maggie Wellington are two of those votes. They're from Boardman, Ohio. John and Maggie, are you there?
We're here.
Okay, I'm a national political strategist for the Barack Obama campaign, all right? Just pretend that I am for a moment, okay?
Okay.
Pitch me what's the strategy going forward to win in November if we want to have your votes and the votes of all of your friends. John, why don't you begin?
Well, I think Obama better come and start saying better things about what he's going to do, because he just keeps on saying, well, we can do what we can do, what we can do, and he's not telling me what he's able to do. Where, you know, when I was with the Hillary, she was saying that when I'm elected, I plan on doing this and that, and he's everything about we and not about I. And he better start saying something like, when I'm going to be president, I'm hoping to do this and that, and I'm not hearing what I want to hear from him yet.
Maggie?
Well, if they team up, well, you know, I'm a Hillary supporter, and I was just thrilled with the way she handled herself during the evening. And to me, she gets stronger and stronger. He needs her experience, because experience is what he doesn't have. And, you know, his views on some of the things in education, I happen to be a teacher, I don't agree with. And I'm hoping that he can sit down with, you know, people from the NEA or, you know, other school organizations and really sit down and see what's going on in education.
All right, so both of you are focused on policy. That's very, very interesting. If Hillary Clinton is not on the ticket, John and Maggie, what would you do then?
I have a wait-and-see attitude because I'm having a real difficult time with this right now because I've heard great orators before full of sound and fury that say absolutely nothing. And right now he's a very, very good speaker. I've seen people and crowds be fooled before, and I just have to really scrutinize harder Barack Obama.
John Vivo, you get the last word. Would you vote for John McCain?
I hate to say, but if it comes down to it, I might have to because he's not going to beat him. He has to come out and start saying more things about what he's going to do for everybody, and he needs support because he's not that well-liked. He doesn't have the education. He doesn't have the input. He doesn't have the main people behind him.
John Vivo and Maggie Wellington Boardman from Boardman, Ohio, a crucial state in the November election. That's outside of Youngstown. Patrick Henry Bass, I mean, consider what John Vivo was saying at the end. I don't know what he was saying about education there. But if he's going to vote for John McCain as a response to Barack Obama, in his view, not being able to beat John McCain.
Sounds like a great strategy.
Well, it's a perplexing kind of response for a voter, as though that's going to show him, or I can't really figure out what's going on there.
Well, perhaps one thought is it's more of an emotional reaction as opposed to reaction based on policy differences, because the bottom line is there wasn't significantly a big difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on many issues. And as they have both said repeatedly, there's much greater difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. So for John to say that he would turn away from the Democrats and vote for the Republican, it can't be driven by policy considerations. It's got to be driven by something else.
But will 17 million people feel that emotional?
That's the question. Are these voters typical of that 17 million? I mean, that's really, really crucial if it is. The other thing that was interesting is that this campaign has somehow convinced Maggie that great oratory is actually a negative.
Yeah, sound and fury.
An English teacher, perhaps.
She
but oratory is unimportant.
Well, what do you make of that? I mean, maybe it isn't important.
Well, this goes to this whole argument.
Is it not important?
He's just a man of words and not a man of action, or at least not any action that anyone can tell because he's, quote unquote, so inexperienced, right?
Right. But, you know, Hillary's no slouch when it comes to speeches, you know. I mean, I don't see Barack as just, you know, someone who goes around like some hologram speaking. I mean, people are definitely responding to some messages that he has also when he is speaking. It's not like he's just giving us empty rhetoric.
But I guess it's the perception versus whatever we could argue potentially people perceive the reality to be.
Well, yeah, people have sort of painted him as if he's one of these, you know, wooden Native Americans outside of a drugstore who you put a coin and he starts talking. He's saying something that's resonating with 18 million voters.
To hear those voters, though, it sounds like they have a way of saying to themselves, this isn't a movement for me going forward. So the crossing the party unity threshold that we've all been talking about this hour is tough for these voters. And that seems to be very, very interesting going forward.
No question. And I just want to make a quick turn because we're coming to an end here on Nollywood, which Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor for Essence, came to talk about. We got an interesting email. If you want to learn more about it, watch Jamie Meltzer's Welcome to Nollywood documentary. It's airing on PBS this month.
Oh, that's
from Mary Lugo.
And
Nollywood.
I'm actually going to get for John for his birthday, The Return of Beyoncé.
Yes.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Birthday.
Should we sing
attractive
happy birthday
women.
For him?
Please
happy
don't.
Birthday
oh, please don't.
To
please,
you.
Please don't.
Happy birthday,
please
John Hockenberry.
Thank you very much. That's what my mother said. Just say thank you, John. It's The Takeaway. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.